So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
I love the smell of formaldehyde in the morning. Give you what you want. And I'm gonna take what I always wanted. You always want it, Katie. Tell me how bad you want it. Tell me. Yes.
Oh. Oh. Oh, Katie. Oh. Who's your daddy, Katie, huh? That's it. Who's your daddy?
That was as good for you as it was for me. What's that? I did? You're kidding me. I really did? I did? Oh my God. I did. I really did it. I really did. I screwed your brains out.
Who is this irresistible creature who has an insatiable love for the dead?
Welcome, everyone, to a huge edition of Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting, and Wei, we have been doing this for almost 3 years, and I really feel that every week has just been a primer for a show like this, where we get to, this is the core function of this show is to, yes, we go and review classic shows, but we really thrive in the shit.
Yes, yes, we certainly do, and how shittier can you get than what we are about to review?
Well, it's a segment that has lived on in infamy over the past decade. Today, everyone, we review the October 21st, 2002 edition of WWE Raw featuring the Katie Vick segment. Now, for many of you Canadian listeners, maybe you've never seen this. I don't know how many people over the past 10 years have gone out of their way to search out this segment, but I, for one, had never seen it in its entirety before this week. But before we get to our review, two big guests are going to be joining us tonight, Wei.
Yes, we have former WWE creative members at this time, Seth Mates and Chris Goff, who we've just conducted the interview with off-air, and it was very insightful. You get to learn about the origins of the name Katie Vick, how this angle was originally proposed.
Plans for Kane. Whatever we say in this review, folks, these guys put much better into context because they were there on the creative staff, Chris even on the phone call when this whole idea was hatched. So two great guests coming up. I encourage you all to stick around and check out that. But let's dive right into things, Wei, because October 21st, 2002, interestingly enough, and I had this mistake, and I always had assumed that this was the Raw leading into the pay-per-view of No Mercy that month. It was actually the night after No Mercy when Triple H had defeated Kane to unify the World and Intercontinental title, and as I recall, it was actually a really, really hot pay-per-view. It had a that year's Observer Match of the Year was on that pay-per-view with Edge and Mysterio against Angle and Benoit, and this led into Raw Monday night in Nashville, Tennessee, which was the first ever Monday Night Raw in Nashville since TNA had launched.
Ah, okay. Just amazing to me that that on the one hand, we would have such great wrestling with the SmackDown 6 and all the other stuff like this. Before we get into the episode, let's recap everybody on how this angle came about. It was last week's review when we talked about the Raw Roulette episode from Vegas, and that show concluded with the TLC 4 match where Kane won basically single-handedly after his partner Hurricane was taken out. After the match, Triple H comes out. Kane is celebrating with both tag titles, and Triple H says, "Kane, I know your secret. You're a murderer. Tell me about Katie Vick." And who is Katie Vick? Well, it was revealed the next week.
In Montreal.
In a soliloquy, basically, from Kane, who had all this...
Did you go back and watch this?
I did.
Oh, what a reporter.
He had all this pent-up emotion within himself. And eventually, it was his love interest at the time, Terry, that would convince Kane to go out there and spill his heart out over this Katie Vick incident. And that's what this Kane character did. He walked out to the stage.
Is this readily accessible?
It is, yes.
Well, let's take a little listen to Kane's soliloquy, because I want to hear this.
Oh, please.
One night, Katie and I, we went to a party, and Katie had too much to drink. So I decided that I should drive her home. I wasn't real familiar with the stick shift, but Katie insisted that we take her car. It was dark. The road was slick because it was raining, and an animal jumped right out in front of us. And I swerved to avoid it, and the car spun out of control, went off the road, and I broke my arm, but... Katie was killed instantly. But it was an accident! But it's something that I have to live with, and something that I've thought about every day since. So, the only thing that I have left to say is what I said to Katie's parents. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy.
So there you have it. Jesus. I just want to know, at what point in this character's backstory, between being burnt, being raised secretly in Paul Bearer's funeral parlor, at what point did he
go to high school?
Did he go to high school? Did he become? Did he go for independent wrestling training? Did he get a driver's license and befriend this Katie Vick?
Minor questions, Wei. Minor questions.
They went to a party and what? Oh, okay. So there you go. Then the episode concludes, of course, with Hunter coming out and making allegations that in the autopsy on Katie's body, they found semen.
Which led to the famous line that Jim Ross spouted out throughout this episode. "There's no semen in professional wrestling." There's no semen in wrestling.
Oh, Jesus. And the line that would end that segment was, of course, the only question Triple H had was whether or not Kane forced himself onto Katie before or after she died. And thus we were led into No Mercy, where the two had a match. That was your go-home angle, by the way.
Yes.
The two had the match, of course, and this was the unification of the Intercontinental and the World Championship, ending 23 years of the IC title. And this was
what
the
a way to go out.
This was the way to go out. Triple H versus Kane. Ric Flair interferes, and Hunter gets the win over Kane, leading us to tonight's Raw.
Yeah, it was really like this was one of the bigger pushes of Kane's career when he had come back from an injury. He was kind of – they had done the brand split earlier in the year, and Kane was earmarked as one of the top baby faces for Raw when he went down with his bicep injury. So when he came back, their idea was to really push this guy hard, and unfortunately, he came back at a time when they came up with this idea for him, and I think it severely stunted him for the next couple of months. But as I've always said with Kane, the man is like Teflon when you look at some of the storylines he has endured, and this is probably at the bottom of them in terms of his career. I mean, there's others that have had some redeeming value, like Snitsky. I thought all the stuff with Matt Hardy and Lita was great. I enjoyed that. That was so over the top fun that it worked for the Kane character, mainly because I don't think it was a main event program in any sense, and it also did not involve semen.
Yes.
At least... not literally.
You're telling me semen does a draw in
wrestling? I guess,
wrestling.
You know...
Lewinsky.
Yeah, I guess in both, deal. You know. He got Lita pregnant, didn't he? And yes. Then with Snitsky, that led to the baby being punted. One of the great visuals
in Raw history.
Right.
But that's the thing about this Kane character. It's always kind of hovered between the realm of camp and, serious... so it's just you look at this character's backstory, and it's just so interesting to weave through and try to make sense.
It's like the craziest of crazy ideas. It's like, well, let's give it to Kane. Kane is this crazy monster character that's kind of its own being within the WWE world.
Although I always have a feeling that they never start out writing camp for Kane. I have a feeling they always start out trying to think of something that'll make him seriously intimidating and scary or emotional.
But unfortunately, it leads up to lines like, I love the smell of formaldehyde in the morning.
Oh, brilliant.
They can't help themselves.
Yeah.
So anyway, Raw begins with a video recap of the Triple H Kane murder angle and Kane denying it, calling it an accident, the car accident that was, and then Hunter defeating Kane to unify the World and IC titles the previous night at No Mercy. Triple H and Ric Flair then come out to start the show, and they brag about ending the 23-year legacy of the IC title, and then talks about Kane nailing Katie Vick and how Kane hasn't arrived yet. And Hunter says, I hope Kane hasn't killed somebody in a car accident, and that's why he's not here yet. And they announce a tag title match for later on in the evening with Hunter and Flair against Kane and RVD.
By the way, John and I had to seek this episode out online, as I'm sure some of you have had as well. And unfortunately, the version that we watched, I don't know if you noticed, John.
It was edited, yeah.
It was heavily edited. Yeah. And we watched, I believe, a UK version of it. And
what was edited was just his what he was saying?
Basically any... Some of the references to the tapes, and of course the actual segment itself, it was edited in its entirety. Up in Canada, we I remember it so vividly because I was watching on TSN, and they aired pretty much for the first broadcast of the show, the live broadcast. They aired pretty much most of it, and TSN basically. We're going to get to it later, but TSN cut it out halfway through. On subsequent broadcasts, I believe they just cut the whole thing out entirely. It was that bad. So you could imagine the panic within the broadcasters at that time.
So Hunter, what we missed here is that he had produced a VHS tape.
Mm-hmm.
VHS tape here in 2002.
That says he would prove Kane would be a murderer and a rapist, and he would show this later on tonight.
And Hurricane, who was Kane's tag partner, they had just dropped the tag titles recently to Jericho and Christian. He runs out, goes for the tape, but then Hunter and Flair beat him down and toss Hurricane into the steps and recover the unlabeled VHS tape.
Blank VHS tape.
Would not have made the cut in my collection way.
Oh, you don't have this tape?
An unlabeled tape like that.
You don't have you wouldn't want
that tape to get lost, Way. And, you know, I give you a tape that's unlabeled thinking it's No Mercy, and it turns out to be security footage from a funeral home.
Yes.
That was very well shot for a security footage. Yeah.
Yeah, very well produced. Yes. Special effects and everything. See those realistic brains?
It's just like there was no subtlety. We'll get to that later. I think we'll set aside 4 hours of today's podcast for our thoughts on that segment. But the show started off with Jeff Hardy against Christopher Nowinski. And Nowinski gets sent to the floor early on, and Hardy hits a somersault dive. This was a period way where I thought just Hardy was just breaking down. I just found he was just really sloppy in the ring and just... I really felt it was after years of all these bumps that he had just really fallen apart. But then, you know, he did go through, believe me, his body was in tremendous amounts of pain, but did really recover years later during that second run with the WWE. But at this point, yeah. Jeff Hardy was not lighting the world on fire.
I completely agree with you. I mean,
Matt was the standout on SmackDown at this point.
At this point, though, like, they're trying the singles thing with both guys after the brand extension, and both were – Jeff Hardy especially was still receiving a ton of fan reaction, especially from you know, the women and from the younger audiences. But you're absolutely right. I thought the sloppiness of his work really stood out here, especially when you compare to Jeff Hardy right now in TNA, who's a much better worker.
So they did a series of near falls. Nowinski hit this double underhook into like a rotating suplex for a two count. That part looked good. Hardy hit this weird up kick off his back. Just really awkward, these two. I found their styles. And then Nowinski got out of the way for a swanton, goes to the floor and takes an axe handle. And then Nowinski grabs a chair, but Al Snow runs down and stops him from using the chair. Hardy drop kicks the chair into Nowinski's face and goes for a swanton to Nowinski on top of the chair. But then Al Snow pulls Nowinski out of the way, so Hardy hits the swanton onto the chair, and Nowinski pins him. This one went 5:56, and then afterwards, Al Snow was unhappy about all this. I was confused.
I was too, and I chalked that up to, you know,
we're not watching every week here,
the previous weeks. But basically, the angle is that Al Snow, of course, had just returned on that episode we reviewed last week, and since coming back, Chris Nowinski was a tough enough contestant. He didn't win. He came in, I believe, like he was a finalist.
It was down to him, Josh Matthews, and Maven.
Right, and Chris Nowinski nonetheless made it into the WWE. So the storyline was that Chris was kind of bitter that Al Snow wasn't able to help him get into the WWE. He wanted to prove that he didn't need Al Snow. Chris was a heel.
Doing a Joey Ryan gimmick.
Kind of, yes. And Chris was a heel, and Al Snow was playing kind of the protective father type of guy. Yeah.
We go to Eric Bischoff, who is at this point the general manager, in his office watching Big Show bully him from the night before at the No Mercy pay-per-view. And Stacy Keibler walks in and wants to referee a match tonight. And he says, fine, just not the main event. And Big Show then walks in, and he had been summoned there by Bischoff. And Bischoff apologizes for last night and says, no hard feelings. And tells Big Show that he's got a handicap match against Rico, Jamal, and Rosie tonight, who were comprising 3-minute warning at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then Al Snow is with Tommy Dreamer, telling him that he didn't want Nowinski to lose. And
this was from the previous week where we saw an instance of the same thing with Snow interfering reluctantly to help Nowinski.
So they're going to have a Singapore cane match tonight.
I always thought it was so weird how you would take the guy, the coach of the pro wrestling show, like the guy who's supposed to be teaching pro wrestling basics, and you would, for his comeback, put him in all these hardcore matches.
Yeah, I never thought that they really... Al Snow is just such a... He came across so great on Tough Enough,
yeah.
I thought. He was just such a lovable character.
A great fatherly coach
figure. They just never were able to bring that to Raw or SmackDown. They were just never able to take that character over and transfer it. Nowinski then shows up and says he doesn't want Al Snow's help. Lance Storm and William Regal come out, one with the... with the Union Jack, the other with the Canadian flag. I guess you can decipher which was carrying which. And Lance Storm cuts a promo stating that the Un-Americans are finished, but he and Regal are together because they share the same view that the U.S. is a zoo filled with crazed savages, and Regal calls the U.S. a cesspool. So this was a... What did you feel about the Un-Americans group, Wei?
They were really just a small blip on the radar. I mean... this concept, of course, had been done for a long, long time. And I suppose this was really Lance's first big break outside of the Invasion, you know? Like, this was a gimmick that really Lance had perfected, I suppose, in other companies. But I personally felt that it really dragged some of the others down. I thought Regal was above a gimmick like this. To me, this is a gimmick. Like, you do an anti-American gimmick, I feel... It's very cliched at this point and also kind of limiting in terms of how far you can go unless they're only timely. And I feel like for Regal, he was a more versatile performer than what this gimmick allowed.
They note here Storm and Regal were taking on Bubba and Spike Dudley in a number one contenders match for Jericho and Christian's tag titles. And they noted Bubba suffered a legit concussion in the TLC match that we mentioned on the Raw Roulette show, which would have been 2 weeks prior. Babyfaces get the advantage on Storm until Regal hits Bubba in the back of the head from outside of the apron, and they play up the concussion Bubba's suffering from. And meanwhile, they show a picture-in-picture here of Kane arriving in his wrestling gear out of his rental car.
No, he doesn't wear anything else.
It's just such a funny visual to me.
He's burnt.
I remember when they would show him at, like, when they would do autograph sessions.
At Access and
yeah,
whatnot.
They'd show just Kane, like, in everyday attire. Like,
he would
a jean
have
jacket
his hair in a ponytail and, yeah, and a t-shirt.
Leisure Kane.
Yeah.
Storm gets clotheslined to the floor, and then they do the what's up headbutt for Regal, but ends up getting stopped by Storm. Spike hits a Hurricane Rana to Storm, and then Storm misses a splash in the corner, takes a Bubba bomb, and Spike hits the Dudley dog to Regal, so the Babyfaces get the win at 3:27. And afterwards, Storm super kicks Bubba right in the back of the head, and then Regal hits Spike with brass knuckles right to the ribs of Spike as Storm holds him up. So they did the post-match attack to further those two along. Then, something that I'm always a big fan of, Way, are photo shoot angles.
Photo shoot angles.
You never see footage of a photo shoot on a wrestling broadcast unless shit's going to go down.
And
Trish was having her photos taken, and then the photographer starts asking, what was up with Victoria attacking you last night? And Trish just casually says, huh, you know, Victoria's obsessed with my sex life. You know, just casually with this random photographer. And then Jericho and Christian walk in, and they start talking about Victoria's insinuations that Trish slept her way into the WWE. And they said, you're the same woman that barked like a dog for Vince McMahon. And they start barking at her. And Jericho thinks that the stories are true, and that later Trish can have an injection of vitamin C. These two played like your assholes you would see at any random club in Toronto on Richmond Street, just playing total douchebag heels, essentially. And who would think that a year from now, vitamin C would be injected into Trish in that storyline? Trish would come around on these two.
Oh, Jesus.
And then
That's
she'd
right.
leave him for Christian.
Yes, you're right. Jericho and Christian, of course, had incredible chemistry together in these types of promos. Both are great comedic, heelish performers, and I think Christian plays a great second fiddle to Chris Jericho. I enjoy these two, maybe even more so than I did Edge and Christian in terms of their vignettes. So, yeah, really good stuff. And this was the start of that.
Bischoff walks out. You know, outside of Katie Vick, this was probably the most noteworthy segment of the entire show, was Bischoff came out and said that at Survivor Series, which was their next pay-per-view, Stephanie McMahon, who was the GM of SmackDown at the time, will find out what happens when you try to out-promote him. The answer was the Monday Night Wars. And calls Lesnar and Undertaker's Hell in a Cell a spectacle and a bloodbath, but will pale in comparison to the Elimination Chamber match. To which the announcers say, what's that?
And the crowd is completely silent. What is this? Elimination Chamber.
This was actually an interesting one because I think it was the exact same week that they cut the budget for developmental and got rid of the Heartland Wrestling Association, which was Les Thatcher's developmental company for the WWE. And the same amount of money it took to run HWA for the entire year was what they spent on this structure.
Really?
So there was a big controversy over what is more important, but the chamber match did draw quite a lot for this company. So that was it. No real explanation of it.
Just a tease.
Yeah. Keebler's walking backstage, and what I noted about this was as she walked down this hall, it was just picture after picture after picture of Eric Bischoff with random smiling poses.
That's
on
funny.
these photos.
That's cute.
And that leads us to D'Lo Brown against Test, with Stacy Keibler as the heel referee. And Ross...
Well, it's not explicit that she was a heel to begin with.
No. Ross compares Keibler to Bronco Lubitsch of world-class fame that
wow.
you can see refereeing just about every match on Ultimate Classic Wrestling on Fight Network. Red Shoes Dugan and Earl Hebner as other legendary referees. Test changed his look for this match. Way he was no longer wearing his leather pants, but rather his trunks.
Trunks. Yeah.
Big transition for the man.
I prefer.
Still had the long hair.
I prefer the pants personally.
This was one of the reasons they said that the un-Americans, Christian and Test, were apparently told to cut their hair, and at least Test was very vocal that he did not want to cut his beautiful hair, which he ultimately would.
Yeah, both of them would.
Yes, both would. Right about the same time, too. Mm-hmm. And not in hair matches.
No.
Just at a barber without any cameras.
That's about time.
I never understand that in wrestling. Yeah. I would never do a significant haircut without making a match out of it. Mm-hmm. Why not? That's mm-hmm. a great spectacle for people.
Yeah.
Keebler slaps D'Lo as the bell rings, and that was pretty explicit.
Yes, that would signify who she was siding with.
And Test hits a big bat body drop and then stomps him in the corner. Test takes a running forearm and clothesline. Keebler counts really slow when D'Lo makes his little comeback. And then Test gets up, goes for a pump handle slam. D'Lo blocks and hits the sky-high powerbomb, but Keebler is tying her shoelace. D'Lo gets upset, turns around, walks into a big boot, and there's a fast count made by Keebler at 221, and then she jumps onto Test after the match. So the two are apparently paired together as a heel unit.
And they were dating legitimately, right, at this time?
Yes, they were at this time. And this would eventually lead to the testicles.
Yes.
The testicles. Terry is in the back, our backstage interviewer, alongside Victoria. And she says that Trish has been sleeping her way into the WWE and says that her and Trish used to be friends and they promised they would make it together. But Trish chose her career over their friendship, and she's a liar. And Goldust walks up, and then Booker walks up. And they cut promos on Victoria. And Booker says that you cannot spell Jericho, who Victoria would be teaming with, without the word ho.
Just great, great dialogue all around on this episode.
This was a callback, though, to Victoria.
Oh, that's right.
The Godfather's Ho.
Yeah, yeah. There you had that. You had a storyline involving a woman sleeping her way to the top. You had a, what the hell?
Booker saying he would shove vitamin B.
No, vitamin T.
Vitamin T.
Booker T.
He was going to shove vitamin T up Jericho's punk ass. What does that mean, Away? Can you please translate? I'm going to shove my vitamin T up Jericho's punk ass. That sounded sexual in nature. Maybe. Don't you remember a few weeks after this, they did that infamous sketch with Jericho and Christian involving the ass cream?
Yes.
Maybe that was to lubricate him for vitamin T.
Probably. Yeah.
This all makes sense, actually, in hindsight.
It all makes
sense. He's a never throwaway. Oh, maybe we're just not looking deep enough.
Oh, this is all brilliant, brilliant writing from the mind of a 65-year-old who thinks like a 5-year-old.
So we, Goldust spanked Victoria at the end. That was the end of this segment. So this is all to lead to a mixed tag, which we had next with Trish Stratus, your women's champion, teaming with Booker T and Goldust against tag champions Jericho, Christian, and Victoria. Stratus was still women's champion here, right?
Yes.
Okay. Trish goes after Victoria at the start, and then Christian is tagged in, and this was an intergender rule, so it meant that the males could wrestle with the females. And Trish crawls to Booker and tags him. Booker goes to the floor and the heel stomp on him, got the advantage. Lawler says this could be the greatest night ever on Raw.
It certainly was.
This has not been a 1,000th moment yet on Raw.
Oh, to me it has.
I would not be shocked if they did a segment on the 1,000th Raw of, like, all the crap. They've done that in the past.
I think they should. I don't know if they're willing to acknowledge this having ever existed, though. Not in this era, not with their ties to Linda.
I think if they just showed the clip of Hunter with the cane mask walking into the room.
Oh, yeah, that would be enough.
That's enough for the audience. They know instantly what that is, and it's not violating any PG codes
that
of any
true.
Sort. I think that's a nice little callback. That's what I want to see on July 23rd.
That would be great.
So the match continues. Goldust went for the Shattered Dreams, but Victoria stops it. And then Goldust kisses Victoria, tosses her into the corner with Jericho. But then Christian attacks Goldust. Booker sends Christian to the floor. And Trish goes for the top rope Hurricane Rana to Jericho. But then Jericho comes back and just kills Trish with a clothesline and puts her in the walls. Trish taps at 7 minutes and 10 seconds. A great heel spot here, I thought, for Jericho. And he keeps the hold on Trish until Booker breaks it up. And Lawler says that Trish could not sleep her way to victory tonight.
No, no. Trish took some huge bumps in this match.
Yes, yes, she absolutely did. And then had back problems later.
Yeah.
Coachman is with Triple H and says, "Why are you doing this?" And Triple H wants to expose Kane as a sick freak and gives out a warning. And then we got a visual warning as we then went back to October the 9th. Of 1992.
At least that was what they printed on the corner of the screen.
The Toronto Blue Jays were playing the Atlanta Braves in the World Series.
Oh, wow. Where are they?
And somewhere, Kane was attending a funeral home. As we will find out, folks, from Chris and Seth, this was not only a legitimate funeral home, but in the very next room, a actual funeral was going on. Which is so wrong on so many different levels.
Present.
I hope no one that's running against Lyndon McMahon is listening to our podcast, because, boy, do we have fuel for them.
Yeah. Present at this production, we were told from Chris and Seth, were Connor,
Vince McMahon,
Stephanie. So those are your directors.
Bruce Pritchard, I think, was there.
Was he there?
And a few writers.
I thought Pritchard watched this afterwards and he was pissed.
Oh, maybe I have it mistaken. Yeah. Listen to the interview.
But the trifecta were there, of course. Hunter, Stephanie, Vince, and under the direction of Vince McMahon, we had this.
Yes, and this, everyone, of all the shows I've reviewed and all the things I've watched and had to take notes for, there was a real pause for me when I was watching this show as I'm recapping what is happening in this video that I really just had one of those "the fuck am I doing" moments.
I didn't want to watch this.
I did not either. To be honest, I felt like I actually felt kind of sick watching this. Like, I texted Way saying I was close to vomiting throughout this.
I remember.
This was really out there. And I love campy, weird shit like this, but even this was just so
uncomfortable.
Yes, uncomfortable. I could not fathom at the time when we were hosting the O'Grady's parties, could not fathom being in a bar and non-wrestling fans watching us watch this. I've been there for many moments at O'Grady's where it's very uncomfortable to be a wrestling fan. We've all had those moments as wrestling fans, but this would probably have taken the cake. And I confirmed with Dan Labransky at O'Grady's at the time, folks, they had the U.S. feed. So there was no censoring of this for the live audience here. Those are the only Canadians that I think saw this live, because TSN cut away from this. Triple H walks in here with a Kane mask on and starts talking to Katie, saying she looked good and she didn't have to die if she had just given him what he wanted.
Katie, for those who have never seen it, is a mannequin dressed in a
cheerleader's
outfit. Was this like
outfit?
A sex doll or something?
Yeah. This was on top of necrophilia. It's like, this is a moot point, I know, in all things, but this is like, you know, 30-something-year-old Hunter with like a simulated teenager. As well, on top of this.
Well, Hunter's playing a teenager.
Teenage Kane. Jacked up teenager.
But, yeah, Katie Vick here lying in a coffin in a cheerleader outfit.
Grabs her breast and...
Oh, this was...
That part was censored.
This was the uncomfortable part when, like, oh my God.
It was like, and then they just worked the punchlines in, saying that Katie feels stiff, and then says, "Speaking of stiff..." And he just looks down at his crotch. He then takes his shirt off, takes off the mannequin's bra and panties, and that's where he...
Hold on. Yes, yes.
He dives south with a hand.
Wait. He grabs the panties, sniffs the panties. Yeah. This is a pro wrestling TV show. He sniffs the panties. It says,
I love the smell of formaldehyde in the morning.
We are just daring someone online to make a YouTube video with the with lines.
I had never seen this portion of the show because, like you said, TSN had cut out. But, like, holy shit, are you serious? Like, I knew this was bad. I didn't think it was this bad, you know? Like,
this was really bad. I love the smell of formaldehyde in the morning.
And it gets worse.
Then he gets into the casket and starts, like, humping the corpse as we cut to this weird kind of dream cloud sequence.
Montage.
Yes, with roses and candles as we hear him having an orgasm.
We hear Hunter moaning, screaming, "Who is your daddy?"
And then it comes back, and this was just, from all the stories we hear, this was clearly just a Vince where subtlety is, there's no subtlety in any of this, but then they went just way above where, oh my God, I did it. I really did it. And his hand touches her head. He picks up this, like, pinkish goo. I screwed your brains out, and tosses the brains at the camera.
Oh.
And we go back to Hunter with Coachman. Hunter is dying of laughter. And somehow, Jonathan Coachman got hired by ESPN despite this segment. Something that did not make the reel.
Yes, something. One of the worst pieces of television I've ever seen in my life. What kind of a sick person would do this to his audience? I just screwed your brains out. That's brilliant.
I really feel this was a pivotal point in WWE, specifically that this was kind of what we would characterize. Like, you watch this, and it just screams Vince McMahon and his form of humor, which I don't know if it was always there, but it was clearly a shift in just a segment that was designed for a very minute amount of people, and Vince being that central audience.
I think it was designed for shock value to get people talking.
And failed shock value, as we will later hear, which made this all the more depressing to me, is that this didn't get the kind of reaction they were wanting. It was just such a low point. And unfortunately, you know, when people talk about wrestling and having to defend it to outsiders, it's segments like this that replace 1,000 other great things that maybe you take from wrestling. To the average person, this is what kind of they immediately center around with pro wrestling. And how can you argue with them when they laugh at pro wrestling when this is the kind of thing that is presented? This speaks way louder, I think, to outside people of their distaste for wrestling than, you know, a match of the year from No Mercy the night before. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's just such a...
It undoes any good that any of that brings.
So this was 1 month after Hot Lesbian Action, and they were able to top or bottom themselves here with this one.
Oh, yeah. A fun side note, if you Google Katie Vick outfit, you will actually find a really awesome article, and I think John knows what I'm talking about. At one point, the WWE started to auction a lot of the memorabilia from their TV segments, and they actually auctioned off, among some things, the Katie Vick cheerleader outfit, the defiled cheerleader outfit, as seen in this segment. And the winning bidders of said outfit, R.D. Reynolds and Blade Braxton of WrestleCrap.com fame. And if you're a listener of the show, I'm sure you're familiar with WrestleCrap. They have a hilarious write-up of the entire deal and an entire rundown of the package. It comes with a certificate of
authenticity
signed by Linda McMahon.
Oh, my God! Are you kidding
me? Yeah, and like 6 pairs of panties signed by Triple H, a Triple H signed bra. Just read it. It's hilarious.
Oh, my God. God, it is signed by Linda McMahon.
Oh, yeah, the certificate. And Hunter actually signed the bra and everything. So
Jesus Christ.
It is very funny. So search that out, WrestleCrap.com.
If you're a Democrat, folks, you better be a wrestling fan.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Wouldn't it be awesome if, like, during some type of debate, somebody just came out dressed in this outfit?
I have a videotape.
And then Linda plays Hurricane and tries to steal the tape.
Yes, yes.
Oh, God. Jim Ross, who, my God, was probably checking the resume after this show, comes back from break and says, miraculously, we are still here on the air. And yeah.
I had to take a break after watching that. Like, I had to take a solid break before I could continue watching the rest
of the
show.
I just soldiered on. It was just so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable. First time I've ever seen it, and probably the last. How do you follow necrophilia? A Singapore cane match between Tommy Dreamer and Al Snow. And the announcers here just start talking about, you'll never see that on 6 Feet Under on HBO.
No, you won't.
No, you won't. You will not. Which is probably where that segment resides in wrestling memory. Snow comes off the apron to the floor, takes a cane shot to the ribs. I feel so out of place here, going back to wrestling.
Does any of this matter?
They should have been the closing angle, really, to the show. Dreamer misses and hits the post and takes a suplex on the floor. They fight in the ring as Nowinski comes down to the apron and aims for Dreamer, but hits Snow, and Dreamer gets the win at 2:22.
I like that the concussion research guy is the one to hit somebody in the head with a unprotected shot.
Bit of a different Chris Nowinski in 2002. We move on to our next match, which is a handicap match with Big Show against Jamal Rosie and Rico. And they mention get well wishes to Pat Patterson, who was beaten down in Montreal last week by 3 minute warning in the ring.
And that was a legit injury. Was it not?
I think so.
Much like it was when these guys attacked the HLA girls.
Yeah, these guys worked. They worked snug.
Yeah.
Lawler says that because of this, Patterson cannot hold his karaoke microphone, which Patterson is famous for going to do karaoke, singing My Way.
Oh.
The storyline here is that Big Show has not been booked on a pay-per-view for 3 months, and he's upset at Eric Bischoff for booking him poorly. Show attacks all three and clears the ring. And then they circle the ring and go for Big Show. Jamal and Rosie attack when Show goes for a tree slam on Rico, sends both to the floor. I always thought Rico was really an underutilized talent on Raw. Great in Ohio Valley when he was used there, and just unfortunately never really got anything going. I think his age worked against him. The guy was like 40 or so when he got back.
Also, he was brought in as the stylist.
Yeah, a tough gimmick to get over.
A billion show.
I always thought Rico was a really good talent. Then he no-sells a bunch of kicks from Rico. Heels get the advantage. Jamal hits a super kick. Show then fights back, takes all three down, scoop slams Rosie, then a side slam to Jamal, and tosses Rico and Rosie to the floor. Choke slams Jamal pre-Umaga for the win at 2 minutes and 54 seconds. And I think this was the beginning of a Big Show push, but not on Raw, as we would later discover.
Was this basically the write-off of 3 minute warning? Would they do anything after this? Because to me, this was the
Big Show. I think they were still around for a little bit after this.
But to me, this was like almost in a handicap match, they were defeated.
Really killed them off, yeah. But I think it was more just to get Big Show over rather than. Because I remember it was at the Survivor Series. I only remember this because of Rico. Where are you, Jeff? God damn it!
Yeah,
remember
damn it, Jeff.
The moonsault. Yeah. They show Shawn Michaels in the back of the World nightclub in a wheelchair, teasing the next segment. And they come back with Coachman, who is with Big Show. And Bischoff walks in, calls Big Show a piece of garbage. And Big Show did not cry. He was very strong for this segment. Did not cry as he was fired.
Oh, yes, yes.
This was actually, like, verbatim, almost the same angle.
Oh, he wasn't fired. He's traded.
Kind of. He was traded to SmackDown and tells Big Show, you will be hearing from my attorney. And I was just curious, what are you suing him on grounds of?
They probably did some angle.
I guess because he shoved Bischoff at the pay-per-view.
I suppose so. They didn't reveal who he would be traded for, but it was later revealed that he was traded for, get this.
Who? I don't know.
A package deal.
Oh.
Ivory, the Reverend Devon, Chief Morley, and I suppose Al Snow was part of that deal as well.
Wow, there's a...
Convenient.
Wow, what a trade.
Yeah.
Big Show tells Coachman not to feel sorry for him because Coach tells to work for that asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go to the Hurricane shows up in the back, opens up the trunk of the car that he's driving, and stands there. Presumably for the next 40 minutes.
Mm.
And they recap the angle with Shawn Michaels where he was injured after the SummerSlam match with Hunter. A fantastic match.
Yeah, we should review that one.
Yeah, actually. We'll do that one before SummerSlam this year for sure. One of the great WWE pay-per-views of all time, I think. and the post-match where he was taken out on a stretcher. And Michaels wheels himself out on stage at the World wearing jeans, which is, I guess, he's in a casual setting, but he's also wearing a visor.
That's right.
A visor, way. There's no excuse. There's no semen and there's no visors in wrestling.
There's no sun indoors, so why do you need to wear a visor?
I think... He's a horrible dresser. Well, like, his fashion sense is just atrocious.
Well, I mean, Sean's over the past 15 years or so, he's always had been very self-conscious, it seems, of his hairline, and he would try to do whatever he can to hide it.
This is a decade ago.
Including a visor.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, the LeBron James is the same thing. That's why he wears, like, a headband. Sometimes he wears two headbands.
Well, it's... I had a friend who always wore a headband everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange what people get into. I used to always wear a baseball cap wherever I went.
Yeah.
It's just, I always hated my hair. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Some people are self-conscious.
Didn't have any reason to.
He says he's still in pain. The rehab's going slow, but he's not going to give up, and he will get Triple H. And if people are skeptical, he will show them how he's doing. And he struggles in the chair and teases that he can't stand up. Then he looks left, he looks right, and he pops up and he's completely fine and says that he will show up some Monday night and he will be back. And I wish they cut here because they kept it on him as he danced like a goof. This dancing was the whitest dance you have ever seen a man do.
Right,
he's a horrible dancer,
folks.
It's
a jig. Some type of jig.
This was the second most offensive thing on the show, I thought. But Shawn Michaels is... ready to return.
Ready to return, and I guess he would be the one to eventually end Hunter's reign, and not the person that is feuding with Hunter at this moment in time. That being Kane.
Yes, he got screwed in the deal. We go to our main event: Triple H, Ric Flair against Kane and RVD. Now, my question is: why was Hurricane not the tag partner?
Not a big enough star, I suppose.
I guess not. He was only big enough to stand by the car. He was the chauffeur.
Yeah.
All four men start in the ring. Flair tosses Van Damme into the steps and right into the back. And Lawler says he never thought he would see necrophilia in the WWE. They just kept talking about this. Yeah. It was like they really wanted to hit this home. We did necrophilia. Hate us. Hate us. What are they going to say about us? And Ross and Lawler start reminiscing about the Kiss My Ass Club, Mae Young giving birth to a hand.
Mm-hmm.
Our bloopers segment is writing itself here.
Yep.
They continue to get the heat on Van Damme. Lawler says that Ross and Kane are the only ones who didn't find it funny. And Ross just says under his breath, there might be one or two more who did not find it funny. RVD finally tosses Ric Flair off the top, and Flair gets called an idiot by Ross. Ross just says, what an idiot. Why does he keep trying this? He's never hit this. And Van Damme hits a spinning heel kick to Flair. Ross and Lawler then get into a discussion about the yin and yang of RVD. Is it yin or is it ying and yang? Is there a G?
Why are you looking at me?
Just seeing if you caught it. I don't have any reason.
No, I don't know either.
Kane finally gets the hot tag, but Earl Hebner didn't see it. Van Damme gets tossed into the pole on the floor. And then Kane, with a top rope clothesline, after finally getting the tag, attacks both. Tries for a double chokeslam, but is stopped. And Van Damme is crotched on the top by Flair. Kane and Hunter fight up the ramp and into the back. Van Damme blocks the figure four with an inside cradle for a two count. Hits a kick off the top. Rolling thunder, five-star frog splash, and pins Ric Flair. 12 minutes and 16 seconds. But we were not there. We were not done there, folks. Kane attacks Hunter in the back. They are fighting towards the car that Hurricane has waiting. And tosses Hunter into a Pepsi machine. Mm. Pepsi. And slingshots him onto the car, onto the hood. Choke slams him onto the hood. And then tosses Hunter into the trunk of the car. Hurricane shuts the trunk. And Kane yells, Hunter, now I'm going to screw you. And the only question is whether you'll be alive or if I'll wait till you're dead. And drives off with Hunter in the trunk. And in a moment that only the gods of wrestling could give us folks to end a show like this, as they drove off in the distance, the trunk popped open by mistake.
popped open, and you could see Hunter inside trying to pull it back as it drives away. But the beauty,
fitting end,
the beauty of live TV.
So based on this finish, it's like Kane confirmed, I'm a necrophiliac. You got me, and now you're gonna feel my wrath.
No, well, that was the thing. Not at any point did Kane really deny the rumors. It was just more so.
You got me.
So that was this episode. The next week, Hunter, we should just get...
What was the follow-up?
The follow-up was that Triple H came out, and he immediately began by saying that, what an idiot, those guys. Next time you lock somebody in, you should get a car without a child safety latch. Ha ha ha.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, Hunter...
Our babyface is just a total idiot.
Yep. So he explains that he got out because of that. And then he begins to conduct an interview with Katie Vick herself. We see a coffin next to the ring. Hunter goes to the coffin, grabs Katie Vick in her cheerleader outfit, and then Hunter proceeds to do a ventriloquist act with Katie, throwing in more brilliant lines like stuff about Kane having a burnt penis. Hurricane then comes out and says that Triple H, in fact, did not escape the trunk last week, and he has video proof now. Then we go to this terrible, not as offensive, but way more boring video. I don't know if you remember, John, of Hunter, of somebody dressed in a Hunter Hearst Helmsley mask.
Hunter Hearst Helmsley mask.
Yeah, laid on a operating table. And there are doctors behind him, and they're just proceeding to pull out various objects out of the ass of this fake Hunter.
How do I not remember this at all?
It lasted forever. It was not very funny.
I remember the Jim Ross ass sketch, but I never...
Yeah.
I guess I really pride myself on my memory, but I guess I have an internal filter because I have no recollection.
They pull a squirrel out, they pull a sledgehammer, Jesus, and then they eventually pull out Triple H's own mask, and they say that Hunter had his head up his own ass.
Really? It was the same punchline as they did for Jim Ross? That was the same punchline.
Maybe you're confusing the two. Or
no, it was definitely they pulled out something of Jim Ross, and it was Vince doing the Dr. Heine sketch with Alex Greenfield, and said, Jim Ross has had his head up his ass.
Well, you have such gold, you got to do it twice, right? Triple H then proceeds to beat up Katie Vick, and Jesus. This feud ends with a match, and Shawn Michaels comes in and helps Kane.
Shawn Michaels was the savior at the end of all of this.
Helps Kane beat Hunter in a non-title match. So there you go. The end of that storyline. For whatever reason, they didn't save this for the pay-per-view. They just decided to end it.
Whatever. What a memory. Well, folks, let's head off. Do you notice I say folks a lot? Fuck, I've been listening back to a lot of my stuff. I say folks a lot. Mm. I say folks and everybody a lot. I'm saying it now so people can call me.
They're not really words. They're not really words you can avoid. Like everybody. Always,
hey, everybody.
What else are you supposed
sometimes
to
it's unnecessary. I'm like, it's just unnecessary sometimes. It's like I'm done the sentence, but I have to add
I think
everybody.
I think I recognize it, but I don't think it bothers me as much as it seems to bother you.
All right. Two people I want to chat with, we're going to head over now to Chris Goff and Seth Mates, two members of the creative staff at this time in 2002. Chris was primarily on the Raw side. Seth was over on the SmackDown team. But as we've heard with the writing teams, they were never separate writing staffs. Guys were working on both shows as well. So both guys adding a lot of perspective here to the greatness that was Katie Vick. So here's myself and Wei Ting chatting with Chris Goff and Seth Mates. Well, everyone, we have just reviewed the October 21st, 2002 edition of Raw, which I think has one of the most endearing segments that has lasted over almost a decade at this point. And joining us now to chat about Katie Vick and many other topics are two members of the creative staff at that time in 2002. We're joined for the first time by Seth Mates as well as Chris. And guys, thanks a lot for joining us here on the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just to put it into context for listeners, we'll start with you, Chris. Just give us kind of your time period with the company and kind of what your roles were right around this time in the fall of 2002, and then we'll go to Seth.
Well, let's see. Yeah, I started with WWF at the time in 1997 as an intern for the television station. I wasn't at Titan Tower at that point. I continued with the television station for a couple of years, and then in 1999 I started with WWF.com and stayed with them for 2-3 years, and I was joined by Seth Mates during that period as well. But in the middle of 2002 or early 2002, Seth Mates and I had talked about possibly joining the creative team. We were both really good friends with Shane McMahon at the time. He was the head of new media and WWF.com. And we were required to try out for the writing team by writing a couple of at least 10-page storyline arcs from start to finish that we both did. We both applied, and Stephanie called us and said we were on the writing team. And that started in middle of 2002, and I was there until March 2003.
And Seth, yourself, I know you worked with the magazine as well. Was it kind of a similar path with Chris transitioning over to the creative team?
Absolutely. We worked together at .com. Chris was more on the production end. I was more on the writing and editing end. And I also did a lot of work with the magazine. And then, exactly, we were friendly with Shane. And that summer, I think he called us both into his office and he said, "How would you guys like to try creative?" You know, he could tell that we were both feeling a little professionally stunted, I guess, at .com, looking for a new opportunity. And we both started on the same day. We started the Wednesday after that Vengeance pay-per-view, after we got back from TVs. And Chris was on the Raw team. I was on the SmackDown team. And Chris's tenure was a little bit longer than mine. I was there basically for a glorified cup of coffee, although it was a pretty eventful cup of coffee. Like I said, I started the end of July, and my last official day with the company was in early December. So it was only about three and a half months, but a lot of big and important stuff. And we hit the quadrifecta of absolute garbage. We did a lot of good things too, but we also had the quadrifecta of Katie Vick, Billy and Chuck, Al Wilson, and hot lesbian action.
Oh, it was quite the time. And 2002 was such an interesting period because it was, you know, it was after kind of the invasion angle. We were kind of in the hangover of that period, and it was sort of like it was time to evolve from the Attitude Era, but kind of the company trying to find its identity as such, and we got to see them, I think, stumble in some aspects, but also, I think, succeed with, there was just a ton of talent on this roster at this point as well, and some very good stuff. I think 2002 is kind of one of those forgotten years in terms of the company. But Seth, we had the Raw and SmackDown teams, but if I'm not mistaken, there was lots of back and forth in terms of it wasn't just writers mutually exclusive to each team.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there was initial meetings and initial conference calls to kind of get the basic structure of each show, and those were kept a little bit more separate. You know, like, for example, and, you know, Chris will speak a little more to this, the call where the Katie Vick character first emerged was a Raw call. So Chris had the joy and pleasure and blessing of being a part of it. I wasn't. But in terms of the actual meetings, you know, on the way to the shows, at the shows, producing the shows, writing vignettes for the shows, that was all a whole team effort. You know, when we said Raw and SmackDown team, that was more the conceptual stuff and some of the minutia. And then you get to the show and the actual production end is and the contribution is everybody.
So Chris, for pardon the pun, but tell us about the birth of this Katie Vick angle.
Well, you know, Katie, like Seth said, you know, it seems like creative has changed a lot since we were there. I'm not, you know, from gathering from other writers talk about their periods there since we left, it seems like we were in the last period where we actually had a lot of face time with Vince McMahon. It seems like there's a lot more buffers now, and a lot of people, it seems like there's a bigger creative team, and a lot of them stayed back now. But at the time, in 2002, we were with Vince, like, all the time. You know, our basic weeks would be you do Raw, you do the Raw and SmackDown meetings, of course. But then on the weekends, all day Saturday, basically, we would have conference calls. I would get up at, like, 8:30, and Seth and I would sort of have to set up the conference calls for Raw and SmackDown, and they would be separate. And so that morning, it was a Saturday morning, get a conference call right at 8:30, and you basically write your Saturdays off. You didn't have many days off in WWE at that time. You had started off, and it could go 2 in the afternoon. These conferences, they were so minutia-filled, and it would end up being stuff that would change like 50 times after the call. So, of course, every week you're just sort of like, wow, this is really too in-depth for something that's going to change 50 times before airtime. But Katie Vick happened. We went through... We were talking about Raw Roulette, and that was the very first Raw Roulette, and we were excited about it, doing the spin the wheel, and we were going through all that, and...
Raw Roulette, by the way, Jim Ross's idea for that name. He came up with it on the plane right there.
Jim Ross, Seth and Jim, big Twitter friends. you know, well, the spin the wheel thing was really cool, but there was a time period there where Vince, all of a sudden, and other writers will tell you, he goes through his ideas and his directions change with the wind. So at this point, he wanted to start having a lot more backstories to wrestlers. He didn't want it just to be like, oh, I want to beat you up. You stole my girlfriend. Let's have a match. He wanted it to be more like, I want to know who every character is, their background, and a lot of that. And as you've seen through the years in wrestling, he's gone up and down with this kind of stuff, whether it's the Waylon Mercy era where you sort of get this weird background story of these people, and then they come in and you sort of supposed to feel like you know them. Well, Kane had obviously been there for a long time, and I think Glenn Jacobs was sort of wanting a little more different direction as well. I mean, we were talking about taking his mask off at that point a lot before it actually happened years later. But, you know, it was just a matter of, like, we want to know more about Kane. We know about the Paul Bearer and the burning angle and the Undertaker scenario, but we don't really know much more about him. So let's spend the last 10 minutes of this conference call discussing, you know, Kane's background and coming up with a way to bring Kane back, because he had torn his bicep. And he was coming back to TV, so blah, blah, blah. So anyway, it started off with us pitching ideas about how to bring Kane back. And several of the writers had ideas. You know, Vince, and it was at the time it was myself, Ed Koski, Brian Gewirtz, Michael Hayes, Vince, and Stephanie. And Triple H was in the background with Stephanie, not married to Stephanie at the time, but definitely had his ears open on these conference calls. And, you know, it was weird because all the ideas were being pitched for. I thought there were some decent ideas being thrown out there, but Vince took them all into account. But at the end of the call, Vince basically made the call to say, like, you know, why don't we make Kane, why don't we say he's a murderer and he's murdered somebody in his past, you know? And it sort of formulated into what you saw. This was Vince's seed. He wanted to make it to where Kane was so horribly disfigured in his high school years. This is a background story, obviously, that he was getting, he was burned so badly, no girls wanted to talk to him except his girlfriend, Katie. I don't know where Katie came from, but we'll talk about how Vic got in the picture. But Katie actually was going to the prom with him in high school, and they were on a crazy, turny road. It was bad weather. And out of a bad novel, he crashed the car, Katie died, and he was never had another woman at that point, and he was forever scarred. And that was the background for Kane and Katie Vick. And it was the weird thing about it is Scott Vick, who, of course, was with the Flock, and Seth can talk about this a little bit more, but Scott Vick was just available to use as talent. He obviously had a run in WCW, and he wasn't a big star or anything. And I remember, I don't think they wanted to use any of the up-and-comers at the time, like John Cena or Batista or any of these guys for this role. They wanted to use somebody that wasn't maybe going to be so... Seth and I have talked about this. No, how many people want to see, like, if John Cena would have started as, like, Katie Vick's brother, you know, that would have helped his career at all, no. So,
And I remember... Go ahead, I'm sorry, Chris, I apologize.
I was just going to say that Triple H said, hey, you know, Scott Vick's available. He wants work. How about we bring him in? We'll call her Katie Vick. And the funny thing is, that's the only Scott Vick came one time. I guess he was completely out of shape and not ready to be used in a major angle like this. So he was totally cut, never looked at again. But Katie Vick kept the last name for some unknown reason. It was already too late to change the name. And Katie Vick was born. What were we going to add to that?
I apologize for interrupting you. As I remember it, we were the way that the name came to be is the last of first. And the way that I remember is at the time, Hunter had just started putting together his faction that was going to come into being. You know, the Katie Vick thing was the build up to the No Mercy pay per view in October, which is the same pay per view I think it was the September pay-per-view with Blair on RVD or something and joins Hunter. So that was all coming together. And there was talk about, you know, that we looked up and down the roster. I'll never forget this. It was on the plane. We looked up and down the roster for guys who could potentially join Evolution. I mean, this was looked at as potentially a huge star-making opportunity where, you know, you have Triple H and Kane fighting over this thing, and then all of a sudden you get attacked and you find out that it's the brother and getting revenge. I mean, this was, you know, and like Chris said, they didn't know anything about Scott Vick. They just knew that, you know, they had heard some good things at some point along the line and potentially would bring him in and we can do a way to introduce him to Evolution. You know, I mean, that's the only reason that the Katie Vick had the last name Vick. I mean, she could have just as easily been Katie Orton or Katie Batista. And the name Katie literally, I'll never forget it, was just an arbitrary name that Stephanie threw out there. We had the last name Vick. I think Vince said, we need a first name. And Stephanie said, hey, how about Katie? And that's how Katie, the name Katie, came out.
Initially, in the discussions, was there any opposition, you know, towards the angle? And I guess more importantly, when was the aspect of necrophilia brought up?
Well, you know, just before Seth goes in, Seth has a photographic memory about everything. You know, the stuff I can add is basically on the phone call. The phone call had nothing to do with necrophilia. The first phone call about Katie Vick was exactly what was just discussed with Seth and I. I mean, there was just basically, we wanted some background on Kane and that his girlfriend died and that he was emotionally scarred. And at the time when he was coming back from injury, Kane, they wanted to put Lita with him. So Lita was going to be sort of the next transition into his next girlfriend. And the part of the idea was to, you know, sort of write her into this angle. That didn't happen until later with the whole pregnancy gimmick, but you know, it was never discussed, the necrophilia, until, as Seth reminds me, until Seth, Triple H said in a promo, you know, basically alluding to, did you have sex with Katie Vick before or after she died? Sort of joking about the car crash. And at that point, I mean, that was just sort of a line. Of course, we all know Triple H. He's a smart ass. He's sarcastic, his character. So he would make a joke like that, and it's sort of a throwaway line in most cases. But as Seth will also attest, when they went to go shoot the vignette with the Katie Vick vignette with the mannequin and Triple H dressed up as Kane and screwed his brains out and all that stuff. You know, it was a situation where they came back from shooting that, and I remember the writers sort of were like, I don't really know how this is going to play. And Bruce was not happy. It was very odd, and we had no idea that it was going to go the direction it went until we actually came back from shooting that vignette, which Vince, Bruce Pritchard, Stephanie, and a couple other writers were at.
Now, in terms of the angle itself, when it was first kind of unveiled at the end of the Raw Roulette Night, was it considered an angle internally, at least, that there was interest for this to go forward, or was there kind of a, you know, this thing didn't really get over on night one? What was kind of the reaction, Seth, after the first reveal of Kane as the murderer?
Well, you know, Triple H, to his credit, as I heard, you know, backstage before he went out for the reveal, because the reveal came at the end of a TLC match.
Mm-hmm.
So he, to his credit, and I don't know if he was just saying this or what, felt a little bad about kind of throwing this out there as a little storyline after these, you know, seven guys, because, you know, Hurricane was supposed to be in the match, but we did an injury gimmick. It just, you know, busted their butts, huge TLC match, awesome match, and then he comes out here and, you know, it is what it is. But no, this was looked at as a big money-making, star-making scenario. I mean, like I said, I mean, the entire idea behind this was to launch a new character, you know, for this to kind of be, you know, go a big thing going forward. I think it was the following week was the Montreal promo that Kane cut, which I think is the episode of Raw that you guys were reviewing. I'll never forget being in Vince's office and Kane, Vince, and Steph going into the other room for a good 2 hours. To go over that promo, and if the crowd does this, then you do this, and if this happens, then this happens, and kind of really going over it, and the crowd still wanted the whole thing because they didn't believe it, but they were determined to get this thing over. I mean, one of my favorite pieces of feedback I've ever received in my career is, you know, I was writing a lot of the first drafts for promos at the time. You know, Chris and I would kind of, you know, rotate doing first drafts of promos to kind of get our feet wet for Bruce or Paul or whoever. And I wrote a promo for Triple H backstage for something Katie Vick related, and I brought it to Steph at ringside to take a look at it, and she started smiling as she was reading it, And I said, you like it, right? And she said, it's too funny. I said, excuse me? She goes, we want to play this seriously. You know, he needs to be more intense. We want it to be more serious. I said, it's about a guy having sex with a corpse. You know, we can't have a little bit of, but they wanted it to be serious. You know, they really did. And like Chris said, I mean, you know, the whole did you have sex with the corpse before or after thing was just kind of Triple H being a smartass. But the punchline at the end of that vignette in the funeral home, and by the way, there was an actual funeral going on in the next room.
Oh.
At that funeral home at the time. The punchline at the end of that, the I just screwed your brains out, is a line that Vince came up with probably about a week or two earlier. And there were times that Vince would come up with a line that he thought was a funny punchline and would literally do everything he could do on television to just get to that line and get that line out there. You know, he must have repeated that line 50 or 100 times.
You know my other favorite one. You know my other favorite one, Seth.
What's the other favorite?
The Nora, the Molly Holly, Chris Nowinski angle. This is another example of Vince having a line that he wants to get in.
I think I know the line Hyman. You're going to say. Yes.
Yes, he wanted to get Hyman written into Raw somehow. So I was actually shooting the vignette with Nowinski and Spike Dudley and Molly Holly, and like Spike and Molly have a little moment or whatever, and then Chris comes up, introduces himself to Molly after Spike leaves, Molly walks away, and then the go-home line was, I can't wait to get a piece of that sweet, sweet Hyman. And it was just, and that's another example of just Vince will have some like really dirty toilet humor line or phrase he wants in, and that's exactly what he did with the screw your brains out, and that was a big capper on it. And how can you have that line, like Seth said, and not think it's going to be comedic in some way around it?
I mean,
they didn't want that.
It was just presented in such a camp, awkward fashion. But what was the reaction like in the back when this segment aired? Because I imagine for the majority of the talent and staff, this was the first time they were seeing it, was when we were seeing it, which actually up here in Canada, we did not see this at all because they edited it off the broadcast. But
we didn't actually see it backstage. Right before the segment was about to air, Chris, myself, and Brian Gewirtz went out to the crowd to watch it with the live crowd. And I'll let Chris take it from here.
Oh, well, I mean, as you can imagine, it got over like a fart in church. I mean, we were sitting there and we were just, me and Seth and Brian were just up here looking at the Titantron, and I mean, the whole crowd was just like, I don't know if they can be appalled because like they're really coming off like a whole like 3 or 4 years where you're talking about Mae Young's hand and all this other disgusting crap, so it's not like it's something new to have some kind of weird angle like this, but I don't think they knew where to go with it. It was so deflating. There was really no reaction. If anything, it was negative. But I just thought it was. You're going to have the guys laughing at the fact that you have, you know, Triple H dressed as Kane banging a mannequin in a casket. I mean, that's funny in and of itself. But I don't think people really understood which way it was going. And necrophilia in wrestling hadn't really been done before, to my knowledge. So it was very deflated. Didn't you think so?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I remember the next morning, we were at the SmackDown writers meeting, all sitting around the table. And I remember Steph and Vince were on the phone with the office with our the communications department. You know, oh, this is going to probably get such outrage and we're going to get calls and it's going to be the entertainment shows are going to be outraged and can you believe WWE showed this and they're getting a press release ready and they're anticipating all this negative feedback, you know, looking for that reaction of being pushy and edgy, not pushy, but edgy and all that. And there was nothing. Nobody cared. And that was, again, a big difference between the Attitude Era and then. You know, the Attitude Era, they would do this and do that, but because they were a hot product, they would get attention for it because it was a sexy story and the controversy and they were cutting edge. But at the time, they had already kind of, you know, jumped the shark from being really the first wave of reality TV, and that's what a bulk of that audience was in the Attitude Era, to, okay, well, it's just wrestling again, so they do stupid stuff, and it's not really important enough to make entertainment tonight, you know?
Mm-hmm. Was there much concern over the reaction of the networks, such as, you know, TSN up in Canada and a lot of the international markets editing the segment out afterwards?
I don't think that was a thought at all. I don't know.
No. Which
time,
is such a contrast.
At that
to
time, it was the adage of like any pub's good pub. You know, I mean that. And as you saw months down the road when, and, you know, Seth can talk about the Billy and Chuck wedding at some other point, but, when that went down and we had all the adulation from GLAAD and all the stuff about promoting the gay angle, and then all of a sudden they give us a gravy boat for Billy and Chuck's wedding, and then they're really ticked off the day after, they make it all a sham. We didn't get that kind of reaction because we didn't, like, truthfully, like, Katie Vick, it's funny to me because, It's grown as WWE's, like, Shockmaster moment. I mean, it's sort of like one or two, like, little things, and the whole idea of necrophilia is so stupid that it's grown into this huge legendary, like, horrible angle. But really, there wasn't a lot of meat to it. I mean, that one promo is the one real thing that made Katie Vick. Otherwise, nothing has ever happened that really went down that road about necrophilia. Billy and Chuck actually, you know, it actually had a big build-up, and you were worried sort of like how big this is going to get. We were sort of wondering ourselves, like, what's going to happen with all these, the GLAAD networks, when we find out that it's a big sham and we're sort of crapping all over the gay angle. But we didn't have that with this because it was really short-lived, to be honest with you.
The thing that people forget, too, about that whole scenario is that match with Triple H and Kane at No Mercy was, at the time, was the end of the Intercontinental title. Here's a belt that's been around 23 years at the time. And we're ending it in the interest of raising the legitimacy of the World Heavyweight title. That was a big deal, and that was totally on the back burner for this god-awful, can't-be-ridiculous storyline.
Let me throw this one out at Seth, because this is something, whenever an angle like this is done, it's kind of discussed, you know, when it's made, there's comparisons made to other shows, but wrestling is kind of this unique animal where I think the audience, they've kind of got certain limits of what they can reasonably take within a professional wrestling storyline, and is murder, is there a way that you can do it that it would connect with the audience and not be kind of just instantly passed over by the audience? Is it just too out there?
If presented as a campy, jokey, ha-ha story and not as a main event storyline for me to be taken seriously, then it's wrestling. Anything can get over. You know, I mean, some of the stupidest stuff in the world has gotten over because it's all about the performers and how the angle is performed and all that. But it has to be presented in a way that is, you know, if Vince's big thing is we want it to be real. We want people to believe in it. We want it to seem like a shoot. There's nothing shootish about that. You know, so if presented as fun and campy and as a sideshow attraction but not the main event, yeah, it could get over and it could be a fun thing and everybody's in on the joke and you kind of enjoy the ride. As a money-making vehicle to try to make me feel like the intensity between two competitors in a world title match is at its peak, no, it's not going to draw money. It's not going to hold my interest, not in the least.
Yeah, although I totally respect Seth and everything, I don't believe murder could ever be over in wrestling because it goes back to the CM Punk shoot interview. That was awesome. Great moment, right? But nothing was ever going to top that moment because CM Punk had the greatest promo ever and you can't go backwards from that. I mean, the bottom line is you have to go ahead and have a wrestling match. And believe me, I know, you know, I've been around wrestling for 20 years now. I know you have to, you know, suspend belief and all this stuff, but you know what? If you have someone murdering somebody or someone killing somebody, it's eventually going to have a match in the ring, which to me is so far-fetched that a murder would lead to some kind of no-holds-barred match to decide it is beyond my belief level, to me personally.
That's part of the reason why pregnancy angles in wrestling will never draw a dime ever, because the baby can't take bumps. And don't give Vince any ideas on that one either. But pregnancy will never draw, incest will never draw, and you know, and as I, you know, I said, what I was saying too, murder will never draw. As a little sideshow attraction, it might be funny, but it won't draw.
That's going to be the subtitle to this week's podcast. Murder never draws.
Because real quick though, once they did kind of turn the corner, you know, this Katie Vick, what is one of the shortest? That's probably my favorite vignette in the history of wrestling.
Sorry, you're breaking up a little bit there, Seth. Do you mind just repeating?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just saying that you know, the moment that they kind of turn the tide from we have to take this completely seriously to it's time to start winking at the fans produced probably my favorite single vignette in wrestling history. It was a cold open to the No Mercy pay-per-view when we were going to get the match with... You can hear me okay now?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we were going to get the match with Kane and Hunter, and also that night there was the Taker Brock Hell in a Cell match, and we had done that god awful storyline again. crap begets crap, the god-awful storyline where, remember, Paul Heyman and Brock accused Taker of cheating on Sarah Undertaker with that Tracy woman?
Yes.
It was just a cacophony of ridiculousness. So this was completely Brian Gewirtz's idea. I love this promo. The show opens with Taker just sitting there in the dressing room. Kane walks up to him, sits down, looks over, brotherly love, and says, "So how was your week?" I love that vignette. It was just such an awesome wink at the fans, acknowledging the backstory and the brothers and whatever, and the fact that they're just both dealing in, you know, crap.
Well, before we end things off, we did get some listeners sending in questions when we said that we were going to be having you guys on here. So we'll just kind of go rapid fire here through some questions. We'll just throw them out at both of you here. This one comes from Louis in Montreal, who wants to know, if this kind of angle with Katie Vick can get the go-ahead from Vince, do you know of any pitches that were similar that did not get the thumbs up? And has Vince ever been behind an idea that you guys were there for that everyone kind of thought was a bad idea but still went ahead with? We'll start with Chris, and then Seth, you can add in anything if you'd like.
You know, just the only angles that I recall that I thought were maybe pushing the envelope a little bit too close to reality that he wasn't big on were any kind of, you know, similar time period, people coming back from injury and you wanted some backstory. So ideas were pitched about steroids, you know, people being addicted to painkillers, coming off rehab, anything that had to do with anything like that, that obviously has a lot to do with the real world of wrestling, was pretty much
Let me jump in for 1 second, Chris. Although, if you remember, at that No Mercy pay-per-view, we did the storyline where Brock broke Taker's hand, and right before the Hell in a Cell match, there's a backstage vignette that Vince wrote into the show that I asked him about, and he said, no, we want to do it, where he gets injected with some kind of a painkiller so he can just so he can get through the match.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
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 So that was one notable exception.
Like, you know, in a throwaway vignette like that, definitely, like, stuff gets away with, you can get away with more stuff and something like that. But as far as a long-term storyline, drugs, total no.
Our next question comes from Jamie Donovan, who asks, while obviously somebody had to pitch this angle to Vince, I have to assume that some poor writer had to explain to Hunter and Kane what the plans for the angle were as well. Did either of you have to go to Glenn Jacobs or Paul Levesque and lay this out for them, or know the writer who did and have any idea what their personal reactions were? And in general, how do the wrestlers respond when they are told to take part in somewhat tasteless or embarrassing angles?
Well, you know, this was... Go ahead, Seth.
No, please.
Well, I was going to say, this wasn't, the necrophilia thing was only really begun in that vignette. So that vignette was done by Stephanie, Vince, and Bruce, and I believe it was mostly Stephanie, Triple H, and Vince were the ones behind that. I mean, this wasn't discussed, this wasn't something, you know, Triple H was involved the whole time, so no one had to explain it to him. He was obviously almost part of the family at that point, he knew everything was going on. Kane, on the other hand, I mean, he was looked at, he was sort of feeling like, as Seth had mentioned earlier, he was getting a little bored with his direction. So he had the big, you know, start in 97, and it ran that course. But he wanted to change it up a little bit. So they decided to, you know, if they were going to push him to go for a title run eventually for the World Heavyweight Championship against Triple H in October. So it was a situation where he knew it was going to be a big push. He's going taking on Triple H. So the angle was basically like there's going to be a backstory here where he's going to start picking on you for your girlfriend dying, and then he's going to start acting like that you killed her, and he's going to start play more emotional, you know, mind games with Kane. That was the pitch with Triple H and Kane. That was the pitch. That it wasn't like, hey, by the way, he's going to say that you banged your ex-girlfriend when she was dead. That was never even talked about until the vignette aired, and then it really wasn't talked about after that again. So that wasn't an idea by Ryder. That wasn't pitched to anybody. That was a vignette that was the sick mind of the McMahon family that was taped in the funeral home that night.
And the original idea behind No Mercy was for Kane to go over and to win the world title. The original pitch was for him to be the first guy in history to unify the world title, the IC title, and the tag titles, which he and Hurricane held until just a couple weeks before that show. You know, I'll never forget there was an agents meeting the day of the WrestleMania 19 press conference that Vince, Steph, Hunter, and a few other top people just happened to be at. And that was the first time, I forget who was running the meeting that day, pitched to the agents that, okay, we're going to put Kane over for the world title and he's going to unify this and blah, 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 blah. And everybody loved it and they thought it was great and, you know, Glenn deserved it.
You're talking about No Mercy.
I'm talking about the agents meeting a couple of weeks before No Mercy.
Okay, yeah. That Shane was. Let's preface that by Shane McMahon was in charge of that meeting because I believe Stephanie and Vince were somewhere like, I forget where they were. But they weren't
the WrestleMania
there.
19 press conference up in Seattle.
Yes, that's where they were. So all the agents under Shane were like, yes, Kane over Triple H for the title, yes. And then finish it.
I was just going to say, then they get back from the press conference and all of a sudden the finish had been changed and all the agents were completely on board with the new finish. Because, again, I have a lot of respect for the agents and for a lot of the top people at the company. But you got to remember, the secret to longevity there is knowing where your bread is buttered. You know, and so, it is what it is. Mm. But in terms of going to the top talent to talk about stuff like this, usually it was Vince or Steph. A lot of the wrestling books you read, you just keep hearing these stories, and I've seen it happen, and it's happened to me where you go in to talk to Vince, and you go in upset or this or that, and you come out feeling like $1 million. One thing, to wrestlers who have questionable storylines pitched to them by Vince and whatever, if you have enough talent, there's nothing, no bad storyline that you can't recover from. But the political clout that you earn by taking one of Vince's ideas and giving it your all, you can get a lot of political clout out of that for years to come. So it was worth the sacrifice to me. And for wrestlers who say, I don't know if this storyline's good for me, and Vince is the one pitching it to you, just, there's a trickle-down effect. If you don't give it a shot, if it's something that is morally disgusting to you or offends you as a person or it's a form of harassment, that's one thing. But, if Vince pitches it, give it a shot. The best performer can take the worst material and make it work.
Did you feel, Seth, that this was a bit of a stumbling block, though, for Kane? Because here he's coming back. He's clearly, as you mentioned, being talked about for maybe even having the big title put on him. And it was kind of in the aftermath of this. I mean, if we fast forward to WrestleMania, he was on Sunday Night Heat. And it really wasn't until they unmasked him later that year in around June that I think kind of got kind of that momentum going again. Did you think that this specific whole feud kind of sidelined him for a bit in just terms of a momentum perspective?
Absolutely, but I think sometimes you kind of need to cleanse your palate sometimes before you move on to the next big thing, or you still have the stink of what you just did on you. He was still a part of the show, he was still making money, etc. The drive behind putting the title on him was, obviously he deserves it, and I think he's a terrific performer. Look at just his longevity alone is incredible. But it was less about specifically putting it on him and more just creating a new star. At that point, the end of 2002, Brock Lesnar had become a star. But other than him, Raw at the time, with all due respect, Chris, Raw at the time was the Hunter and Shawn Michaels show already, and it would become that for years. And it was just, you needed some new blood there. And that was what was behind the drive to put the title on RVD and Unforgiven, which was the original plan. That was the drive to put the title on Kane. That was the drive to put the title on Booker at WrestleMania, which I think was also the original plan. It was just about creating somebody new.
Our next question is from G. Hall, who wants to focus on the positives. He wants to ask each of you, what was a storyline that you both pitched or had a significant amount of involvement with that made TV that you are both proud of?
Let's start with you, Chris.
Well, I'm trying to think. The hard thing about this stuff, and I'll say this more about Raw than SmackDown, because I think Seth had a little bit different situation on SmackDown, but with Raw, and Seth will admit, and because he's very jealous, that Raw was always will be the number one show to Vince, and that counts a complete afterthought, which it works out for people like Seth, because, it allows more creativity and more originality on your part when you're on SmackDown. At the time, Raw was really awesome, but SmackDown with Paul Heyman and Seth and David Lagana, it's like, they had a lot of more carte blanche in some ways because Vince had the microscope out on Raw. So my point is, on Raw, it's really hard to pitch. There's a lot of angles pitched by me and Ed and Brian, but the problem is none of them ended up being like anything that you ever really original pitched. There's so many levels. And as Seth was talking about earlier, whoever talks to Vince last wins. That's what stinks about having Triple H in the family now. It's because whatever, well, he's not really a full-time worker, obviously, but at the time, when he was, he would always get the last laugh because he'd see him at dinner that night. Say like, hey, by the way, I know you want to put it on RBG, but I think I should have it for another month. Oh, okay. You know, that's just how it went. I was in charge of the women's division at the time on Raw, and at the time we had some really good players. We had Molly Holly, Victoria, Trish Stratus, Jazz was being thrown in there. You know, there were some good workers, and I really think Victoria grew tremendously during that point. I remember we had Fit Finley was still the agent there for the girls, and Trish and Victoria had some really good, like, hardcore women's matches at the time, which really hadn't been done on Raw before. And I was basically, like, the guy involved with that. But as far as the other pitches for the tag division and the main event stuff, I mean, sure, there was a ton of pitches being made, but all of them basically came down to, during our tenure, as Seth said, we wanted RVD over. Everybody wanted that. We were pitching all these ideas for RVD. Seth remembers well the RVD promo seg that went like 10 minutes long, and he got so much heat for it that he was never going to get the title ever. You know,
not his fault, by the way. Not his fault. Not his fault. He was sandbagged by others, and it worked.
Definitely. You're absolutely right.
And that's all I'll say about that for now.
Lots of pitches for Kane winning, lots of pitches for Booker T winning. I mean, like you said, the hangover from the invasion angle, trying to get anyone over from ECW or WCW at that point was what we were trying to do, and it just didn't work out because, again, it's when I always say this, when I read everyone bashing creative, granted, you can do a little bit of that because it's just part of the process, but nothing that anyone pitches outside of Brian Gewirtz is 100% untouched and not somebody else's fault. I mean, it trickled down so many levels that no one can be blamed or given any one thing.
I love when creative gets the blame for things, and the only reason why that happens is because you can't call out Vince, you can't call out the top wrestlers, you can't call out the agents, you can't call out the other wrestlers because you'll be blackballed. So what do you do? Oh, it's creative. This mindless, you know, not mindless, it's faceless
group.
Creative
has for you. If I hear that one more time, I mean, yes, that's Johnny Laurinaitis' like outline. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You know, it's you know, people can rip on, for example, people can rip on Brian Gewirtz all he wants. Oh, he's just a comic book guy. You know what? So is the freaking WWE champion, who's the coolest dude in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, Brian Gewirtz was a guy. And listen, Chris will tell you, Brian Gewirtz and I were not friends. You know, I was a Heyman guy, and there was, you know, lines drawn on the team from time to time, and we didn't all get along, but we worked together. But Gewirtz was one of those guys, and again, I'm not a fan of his, like in a personal way, in a lot of ways, but he was in there championing exactly the stuff that people online champion, and a lot of the fans who've gone away champion, wanting to make new stars, wanting to whatever. And yes, there were times that he would write these, you know, can't be silly, whatever, because you work with what you got, and a lot of it was for the lower downtown to try to just give them something to do. A lot of guys who would just be, you know, nameless Sunday Night Heat jobbers if not for that.
The comic book line cracks me up. I run a promotion here in Kansas City now. 90% of the boys are huge comic book guys. So anytime someone like Triple H calls Brian Gewirtz like a huge comic book nerd or whatever, I think it's funny because that is your audience. That's who's working for you. It's the same kind of people.
Meanwhile, the Avengers, Spider-Man, Batman, whatever, are going to draw a combined $3 billion at the box office this year, you know, and maybe that, you know, should send them a message about that.
Well, guys, this has been just an awesome chat. The time is just completely flowing by. I want to thank you both for coming on. I'd love to do this again sometime in the future. But before we go, I definitely want to get some plugs out for both of you guys so that our listeners can follow you on Twitter. And Chris, as well, your promotion there. You were the producer of just a phenomenal documentary on the history of Kansas City wrestling. So let our listeners know where they can follow you and any information you want to pass along.
Yeah, that documentary, it's a few years old now. It was called KC on the Mat. Very fun to put together with Bob Gagel and Harley Race. That's available on our website at kcmetrosports.com. I work for a television station here in Kansas City called Metro Sports. It's a 24-hour sports station, and on that station, they allow me to put on a weekly one-hour wrestling show based on some monthly television tapings I have. The federation is called Metro Pro Wrestling. You can go to metrowrestling.com. Or you can follow us at KC Metro Pro. We're also on Facebook, And we are going to have match number four of Cole Cabana and Adam Pearce. See if Cole can put out Pearce on July 21st in their Seven Levels of Hate series. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. But that's and where you can find it.
Chris, can I get tickets for that at MetroWrestling.com?
You can. You can buy tickets there, Seth. I will probably give you one, Seth.
Oh, that would be terrific.
It's the
you
perks.
Pay for the house?
Yeah, I pay for the house sometimes, yes.
Yeah, you're going to pay for the house.
And Seth, tell us about your Twitter account, which is a must-follow, I think, for any wrestling
fan. Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you. Now, it's at Seth Mates, S-E-T-H-M-A-T-E-S. And one of the nice things, I'm working in media now, happily out of the wrestling industry here. So I kind of have a little bit more leeway than many who are either still in the industry or still might need to get back into the industry. I'm happily out of it. I love wrestling, but hate the wrestling business is the best way that I can put it.
Wow.
So I have a little bit more leeway to tell stories and get into it a little bit more, and so it's a lot of fun, and I love hearing what everybody has to say, and I try to answer as many followers as I can and all that stuff. And listen, I'm a complete and total and utter nobody who had a very cool job at one point and I think has some interesting insight into the wrestling business. So I just think it's cool that, you know, that many people care about what I have to say, and it's fun to hear what everyone else has to say.
No, well, I appreciate the time both of you guys provided for us. I thank you for getting into a time machine and reliving what I think was a monumental angle that we can, as wrestling fans, all enjoy in hindsight. And you guys were right there in kind of the driver's seat experiencing this all firsthand. So thank you guys so much for joining us. Would love to do it sometime in the future. And all the best to both of you.
Thank you very much.
All right, and I want to thank Chris and Seth very much for joining us. Awesome chat with both of those guys. I really enjoyed kind of picking their brains, which sounds silly. After our angle discussion. Let's go to feedback. We have a few of them, including someone who was at that show live. Let's start off with
Stormy Woods, who was personally at the show. And let me say, I was traumatized. Even though I couldn't see the Titantron, just the grunts from Hunter and the creaking of the casket sent shivers down my spine. I've never gone on YouTube to see the show as I don't want to relive Katie Vick, especially that segment. Highlight of my night was seeing Lita, even though she was still out with her neck injury.
Move over to Alexander Rios. I'll be the first to admit I have a very immature, sophomoric sense of humor, but even I was just disturbed by the whole Katie Vick thing. If this was a way to bring up developmental talent, Scott Vick at the time, it failed on so many levels. Triple H dry-humping a mannequin in a coffin in a cane mask was just disturbing. And then on SmackDown, you had Undertaker's ex-girlfriend from the 90s in that program with Brock Lesnar and the broken hand? I mean, what was the endgame here? Was Kane supposed to come out as a world champion, a more sympathetic babyface, Triple H a more sinister heel? Because if you ask me, he was doing this kind of stuff back in 2000 already. I think a lot of those things were kind of the goals here with Kane, even as we mentioned in the interview, discussed to win the title at one point. But overall, I thought that was one of the things I didn't always enjoy about the Hunter character, was that he would do these kind of angles where it almost... the babyface had to come out on top. There was like this instance. There was Booker T where they really hit that race card really hard going into WrestleMania 19. But then in the end, it was Hunter prevailed. And it was just like, now the babyface is just two steps back from where he was to begin with here. It was like they were throwing out this heavy angle, setting up the babyface to prevail, and then the babyface fails. And I just didn't think that didn't do any good.
And you could see the company really suffering for it in years later with their lack of stars, unfortunately. I mean, they had something with Booker, they had something with RVD, and for that matter, they had something with Kane, but the time was just, they didn't capitalize on it. Finally, let's go to, our next feedback, who says, I couldn't help but make several observations throughout the show, such as how young Ric Flair looked 10 years ago compared to today. He has aged a lot in the past 10 years. I guess that's what a few divorces do to a man. Snow and Dreamer have a backstage dispute, so just like any other normal people, they settle their differences very specifically by booking their own Singapore Kane match. I guess Bischoff didn't mind the talent booking their own matches. The cameraman being more interested in Stacy's shoelace and zooming into it instead of shooting the match. And finally, the Hurricane doing the same thing as Kane. He pulled up in a car and came out wearing his superhero gear. I thought he could fly. Why is he? Okay. Overall, a very average Raw, but it gets points for being so ridiculous it was entertaining for me. 4 out of 10.
So I want to thank everyone for your feedback, which we post up every week on the Law message board. And for those of you that maybe are new to the show or sampling it for the first time, we do numerous podcasts every week. Myself, Way, and then the Law Sunday Night with Dan Labransky and Jason Agnew. And you can always tune in liveaudiowrestling.com. You can subscribe for free on iTunes to Live Audio Wrestling. Leave us some positive feedback. We always love feedback, Way.
You leave negative feedback too?
No, don't. Just email me that or post it on the board. Don't fuck up iTunes for us. I'm very vain in that sense. But
you can criticize how often John says everybody in, folks.
Yes, everybody. And Review Away we do every Wednesday here on the site, reviewing classic shows from the past, or not so classic in this regard. But before we end off here, Way, 2002, it was just such an interesting kind of year for the company, because I think they really didn't know really what direction they were going on. This shows a clear kind of reaching for the Attitude Era, when I think that shock value was really worn off and it was just desperation. While at the same time, you were getting some of the best matches the company ever produced, with such a solid roster, but I think at least on Raw, really just not a clear direction.
It was also the first year, a complete year, where they didn't have any competition from WCW.
Right.
And, you know, in some ways they're trying to fabricate that with their brand split. But I think it just also provided a real lack of focus and a real lack of direction from the company. And, you know, we could kind of see that in what I'm assuming is your next pick.
Yes, for next week, we're going to take a break from the Raws and go back. We're going to stay in the 2002 time period, but go back a couple of months to what I feel is one of the more underrated shows the company put on. It's the Vengeance pay-per-view from Detroit, Michigan that year, and it's headlined by a three-way match for the WWE title, the undisputed title at the time, between The Undertaker, The Rock, and Kurt Angle. And this is also, Way, John Cena's first pay-per-view match. WWE recently posted a list of John Cena's top 50 matches to coincide with his 10-year his 10 years with the company. So this was pay-per-view number one.
Taking on Chris Jericho.
Taking on Chris Jericho. So we're going to go back and review that show next week. And I guess in the meantime, folks, you can always follow us on Twitter, at Law Radio, at Way, WAI0937. And I want to thank Chris Goff and Seth Mates once again for joining us. You can follow at Seth Mates and at KC Metro Pro on Twitter. Two great guys to follow and two guys that were right there during this time period. So a big thank you to them once again for stopping by. And Way, you have the enviable task of ending this podcast off with a song.
I'd like to dedicate a song to a very special lady. This song is, of course, about a boy who borrows his dad's car, goes out with his girlfriend, and unfortunately swerves and kills her. And this boy has vowed to become a good person so that he can meet her in heaven someday. And so let's play Last Kiss by Pearl Jam. This goes out to you, Katie Vick.
Beautiful. There.
is I'm at a funeral home with a dummy in a coffin.
Oh my God.
I'm naked except I've got a skin colored thong on, right? So nobody can see. With Kane's mask on, pretending I'm Kane, I'm on top of the coffin having mock sex with this mannequin.
Oh my God, no. And Jesus Christ.
Oh yeah. And Vince is yelling at me, God damn it, do it harder, make more noise and stuff. It's gotta be over the top. And there's a funeral in the next room going on. I'm not sure. The funeral director just like opens the door and sticks his head in to look in. I like look back. I got this Kane mask on. I'm buck naked. I mean, you know, how you doing? Good to see you. He's like, yeah, okay.
Oh, God.
Yeah.